Hi, I'm Chloe McCulloch, Editorial Director for Building Magazine and Housing Today. And this is Home Truths, a Building Talks podcast looking at the housing crisis, brick by brick. Your presenters for this series are two people well-placed to break down the issues around Britain's broken housing market. Peter Bill?
Yes, I'm Peter. I used to be important. But before I was important, I worked for 20 years in the building trade as a QS. Half of that time working for a house builder. I then moved on into journalism. Years ago, I edited Building Magazine, and slightly fewer years ago, I edited the Estates Gazette magazine. A bit later than that, writing a book called Planet Property, and a bit later than that, writing a book called Broken Homes, Solving Britain's Housing Crisis.
And Jackie Sadek.
Yes, I'm Jackie, and I've spent way over 40 years in the property development and urban regeneration industry. I started my career at the London Docklands Development Corporation. I've worked for private sector developers, I've worked in the public sector, both for local authorities and for government agencies, and I ended up as a government advisor. After coming out of government, I then co-wrote Broken Homes with the aforementioned Peter Bill.
Peter and Jackie will be pulling no punches, either with each other or with the high-profile guests they'll be talking to each week about how we provide the housing the country needs to thrive.
Actually, what we do need is a very radical rethink about how we provide housing in this country. And it's affecting everything we do. It's affecting our entire economy.
Houses are built by house builders to make money. And if they can't make any money, they stop building them like they did last year. So we thought it would be worthwhile exploring this issue. It seems to be terribly important to everybody, but there seems to be no answers.
So keep listening for the thoughts and ideas of key people from across the housing sector in this pivotal election year.
This is Home Truths,
a Building Talks podcast.
So, Peter, here we are again, my love. I don't know what I did in a previous life to keep having to sit in rooms with you, but hey, here we go again. Absolutely delighted to say that our guest today is Jenny Daly, the Chief Executive of Taylor Wimpey, formerly of Harrow Estates and Redrow, and a planner by training. We're very, very lucky to get her. She gives a very thoughtful analysis of the housing market, and I want you to be well behaved.
Yes, indeed. I do promise to be well behaved. I always am. I'm very much looking forward to meeting her and for a very interesting debate. Planning is obviously going to be an issue. Jenny's a planner. We'll try not to hold that against her too much, but I'm sure she'll come out fighting her corner.
So for each one of these, we pick a title, don't we, Peter, as to something that's going to come up. And for reasons that will become incredibly obvious as we go through the interview, our title for this one is In Violent Agreement.
Which is not something I normally am with anybody.
This is Home Truths, a Building Talks podcast.
So, Jenny, you and I go back rather a long way, and I've watched your meteoric rise to be a chief executive of a FTSE 100 company. And I know you had a really interesting and kind of colourful childhood, but I do wonder, what about your parents? Aren't they bursting with pride about how far you've come and the fact that you are now a captain of industry?
Yeah, I mean, look, they're very proud. They're very proud of me. My mother, regrettably, you know, passed away, some years ago, and she would introduce her children. You know, here's John, he's a civil servant. That was really important. Here's Rosemary, she's a doctor. Here's Dermot, he's a chef. And this is Jennifer, and I'm not really sure what she does. My parents really couldn't get their head around what planning and sort of house building, because you know they grew up in a very different world, but they that didn't stop them from being proud, and they were very proud. But yeah, I mean, growing up in Northern Ireland, I was born in 1970, so giving that away, but literally, you know, start of the Troubles, and you know, in a really desperate housing situation. Under gross undersupply of fit housing, and it drove a lot of community tension. You know, there was a huge level of sort of disaffection, and look, you know, I'm not going to overstate that, but some of that then did spill into the more sort of sectarian sort of issues that plagued the province then for such a long time, and I did have the security of growing up in a council house. And that was really important. And, you know, something that still, I think, reflects on how I moved through my career. You know that I spent quite a lot of time as a non-executive director at Peabody, and I was really proud and, you know, to be able to put something back by giving them support. And, you know, and it does play through in some of the conversations that we've had about we can't, as Taylor Wimpey or as the private housing sector, meet all need. But we do have a societal responsibility to make sure that need is met.
And you may have had the security of a council house and a happy family. And I think you did have the security of a loving and happy family and a very good framework around you. But you still had to do all your homework while the bombs were going off in the street. And I can't imagine how that could have been. And you know, my hat is off to you. And just to say, while we're talking about community tension, I did a conference day before yesterday with a whole bunch of Section 151 officers from local authorities. And the prevailing thought there was, you know, about community tension being caused in all their communities because of poor housing provision and the lack of housing and shoddy housing for, you know, and the problem of homelessness. So it's very interesting to hear you say that that was a factor in Northern Ireland, because I'm sure it was.
Yeah, no, very definitely. And, you know, although planning was something that was introduced to me by the husband of my biology teacher, believe it or not.
Well, there you go.
But, you know, why was it attractive? It was attractive because, you know, planning is there to, you know, sort of drive change on behalf of the whole community.
Was he a planner?
He was a planner, yeah, in the old Department of the Environment in Northern Ireland. Yeah. But, you know, I was just going to pick up, Jackie, you know, that point about the impact of housing or poor housing. And I don't think that we talk enough. You know, I would talk about the commercial side, we'll talk about numbers, but we don't talk about the effect on the individual or the individual opportunity, you know, the failures that we have around social mobility, the fact that it's limiting economic mobility, the fact that the NHS is, you know, crowded and the cost because we can't put people back in to housing that is supportive and, you know, that is fit. The fact that, you know, if population, you know, birth rates are falling, it has a lot to do with deferred household formation, overcrowding, you know, and all of those things. And actually, educational attainment, health, all of those things are linked to the availability or lack thereof of good quality housing.
Can I start off with sort of planning-y stuff? I'd like to get that out of the way because it can get very boring very quickly, planning. House builders build houses to make money. Okay, that's pretty obvious, really, isn't it? And you've articulated that in the press several times. And to do so, they build to the rhythm of the economics of the country rather than the desire to build 300,000 houses a year. So last year, you built, I don't know, 20% fewer homes than you did the year before for very obvious reasons, which is the sales rate has gone down. And I don't think people really understand the rate at which you build homes is dictated by your desire to make money out of building the homes that you build. And I just wondered if you just explain that to the listeners as to why you built 20% fewer homes last year and you might build 20% more this year. Could you just go through that sales rate issue and how that impacts almost everything from the buying of land to the final product?
Okay. I mean, I think, first of all, yes, you know, I lead a business and our main focus is the delivery of private homes for sale. I'm very proud of the fact that about 20% of our output is affordable housing. So, you know, we do support, you know, other parts of the housing sector. But I think fundamentally what you're describing is there's a difference between housing need and housing demand. And my primary focus and the private sector's primary focus is to meet demand. And, you know, and that does vary affordability, sort of wider economic concerns, cost of living. All of those things tend to operate to vary the levels of demand on an absolute basis. But, you know, demand also makes up some of the need. And then there are some elements of need that can't be affected through the private market.
There is demand and there is what you're willing to supply. Everybody would love a nice house. So the demand is almost unbounded. But you only meet the demand on the basis of what you can make money from, surely, obviously.
What we would term effective demand.
Effective demand.
So the ability to achieve a mortgage, so mortgage availability, and the ability to fund the mortgage. And you know, so last year, what we suffered was a reduction in the ability to affect demand, not because of mortgage availability, which remained very high, but the absolute affordability of mortgages given increases in interest rates. Mm. And around the elasticity, you know, so, you know, yes, we could increase demand by reducing price, but there's a level where that becomes uneconomically viable and my business would collapse. And if my business collapsed, then the capacity of the sector to deliver housing need, which meets and housing demand would reduce. So the sustainability of a business is really important.
To you and your peer group, what you've said is obvious, okay, and therefore this year or 2023 there'll be fewer houses completed. Why is that? That tells you that about whatever percentage you'd like to put on it of the housing supply is dictated by the market. 60-70% is dictated by the market, even the supply of affordable housing, because it's linked to the supply of private housing. Now, if that's the case, why is the complete silence over the fact that 60-70% of the housing supply is supported is dictated by the market when it comes to discussing targets and so on?
Well, look, there's a real knotty point there. You know, if you go back in history, we had a multi-tenure strategy for housing delivery, and particularly if you look at the 50s and 60s and 70s, what you had was the private sector delivering, you know, quite a substantial amount of housing, but you also had council house build and you also had housing associations. And in those days, council house build was significantly greater than housing association. The private sector can deliver to meet demand, and we would continue to grow if there's the delivery of viable land in order to do so, to meet that demand. I think what we're experiencing now is an ever decreasing capacity of the other elements of housing supply overall, whether it's funding, whether it's access to land. You know, the complexity and unpredictability of planning affects everyone, not just private house sector, but housing associations and others. So there's been a real sort of atrophying or sort of a hemorrhaging of capacity in the sector in absolute terms over a protracted period of time.
I mean, if we can come back to that, I'd like to discuss how you might get involved in that later. But can we just deal with this planning thing, whereas it needs to be fixed? Everybody's tried to fix the planning system for the last 100 years. The last time I remember I got involved in it was in 2004 with Labour. Mm-hmm. And the 2004 Planning Act and huge
local development
reports,
frameworks, if
all
I remember.
All that stuff. Yeah. And the fact that, Kate...
Jenny's a proper planner, you know. You better be careful.
I will. And Kate Barker and her stuff and the Ovarat report on £1 million worth of how it can all be fixed. I remember having a breakfast with Lord Faulkner at Cummer's House talking about how it was all going to be fixed. And then he buggered off to another job 5 minutes later. That clearly failed. Why do we keep going on about it needing to be fixed when maybe there isn't a fix?
I just could not accept that degree of fatalism. It is broken. And I think it is becoming more broken, you know, by the day. And I do worry that it's becoming such a big issue that it's becoming, you know, nobody will tackle it. And I feel really very strongly that when we talk about planning, we're talking about planning for house builders and, you know, housing delivery. But actually, let's talk about planning and everything that it delivers. Our infrastructure is underinvested and, you know, under planned. We don't have a strategy. Jackie and I, many years ago, we were talking about the industrial strategy. It needs planning. I sit in meetings with other chief executives of multi-sectors, big data, logistics, you know, communications, everything. They're all struggling to get through the planning system. And that is fatal to our economic health, wealth, and, you know, sort of happiness. So we have to grapple with it. And look, if there's benefit to housing, wonderful, and I'd like to see some of that too. But we cannot have a system that effectively has all the barriers unless you go through planning, but planning becomes a conduit that just won't work.
What on earth would you do besides pour money into it, I mean?
Well, I mean, resources, certainly. I mean, in the end, you can't expect anything to work if you just simply don't have the resources. And the level of underinvestment over the last, you know, sort of 14, 15 years in the planning services of local authorities in particular is, jaw-dropping. I think it's about 80%, or sorry, 60% fall in funding to local authority planning departments. It doesn't matter how perfect the system is. I mean, our legislative construct could be wonderful, but we don't know because actually there's just not enough people to do it.
So what would you do?
I mean, I do think that we need a national plan. I think things like...
No, I mean, right at the ground level to make it easier for small builders.
Yeah, but I think if you try to fix everything from the drains up without some form of strategic, you know, will and plan, you know, on the bottom from the top down, then actually, you know, you're not going to get anywhere. Some of the problem is that, you know, yes, underinvestment, lack of intent, and a failure of local authorities to deliver local plans. Why have they failed to do that? They haven't invested in the resources, but also government and governments over a long period of time have constantly taken something that should be considered over a long term, and they've tacked back and forward. They've changed policy overnight, expected to have results in something that requires long term, sort of patience and direction. And then when it doesn't work immediately, which planning is just not set up to do, they've changed it again. Yeah. And then you apply that back to a frustrated, underinvested local authority, and the decision to do nothing starts to be a preferable decision than trying to keep up with all of this, you know, tacking back and forward.
Yeah, but we live in a democracy, and the other side of the coin is all these people who don't want whatever it is you want to do. And I wondered how much of the delays in the system is due to people exercising their democratic rights and how much is due to the failure of the mechanism itself.
But this is why I go back to, you need that strategy. You need a government that has a plan. And what plan for housing, plan for infrastructure delivery, plan for industry and commerce. Because then the evaluation of things on the ground become less about the individual, actually, I don't want it in my backyard. And I don't really like that sort of language because it has a direct impact for me. And you can grow the conversation into, well, what does it do for us as a community, as a population, as a whole? And, you know, from a housing perspective, everyone can say, I don't need it here. But eventually, that means that no one is housed, and it's a fundamental requirement. So there's a need to effectively gather community, and the definition of community for me isn't about local, hyper-local. It's about our responsibility on a social scale.
Right, last one from me before, because I see Jackie's beginning to sort of, you know,
trying to shut you up.
Having a go at your traces here. If it was fixed, let's say that you got a situation where the planning system was working okay. You can never get it more than working okay. Would it mean you would build any more homes?
Yes.
How many?
Well, look, I think that growth is something that, you know, I would be ambitious for. And we talked just a moment ago, our housing numbers, our delivery has fallen, not just Taylor Wimpey, the whole sector's has fallen, as too has housing associations because of the cross funding. So, you know, they're suffering the same sort of market issues. So we're in a market shallow. We're hopefully somewhere around the trough. Don't think about it, though, in a year. Think about it over a whole cycle and the opportunity to deliver over a whole cycle. There are other issues other than planning, but planning has become a fundamental problem in our ability to deliver. We don't have enough certainty, predictability and visibility around local plans, which means it's really hard for me to decide how do I invest in growing my business? Where can I grow my business? Growing my business isn't about growing demand.
What I'm trying to get to, being a QS, is what impact a less imperfect planning system would have on your ability to grow in percentage terms, let's just say.
Yeah. So if you take building, so that's where I was getting to. Last parts of the cycle, you know, in sort of 2018, 2019, 2020, 21, early part of 22, we couldn't build fast enough to deliver for demand. And there are a number of reasons for that. And they're not short term. It's building skills bases. It's having a consistent flow of land. If sites are delayed because planning is delayed and I don't get it open quick enough, I can build as quickly as I can, always being mindful of delivering a quality product for our customer, but it's not smooth. And when delivery is not smooth, then your productivity falls. So if you had a more consistent planning system that was more predictable and certain, and you knew how to get your resource planning into place, then yes, we'd still be taking a risk at the speculative end around, the ability of the customer to buy, but we would be able to use our resources in a much more productive way and just there be able to increase overall.
And need smaller land banks, presumably, if you had good...
They're not land banking, are they?
Peter, yes, it doesn't make sense. I mean, at the moment, I've got a land bank of 80,000 plots, and my output last year was over 10,500. But I didn't invest in my land bank thinking that I was going to run a business at 10,500 plots. I expect that what goes down will come up, and that I will be able to grow again. And if planning was more certain and more consistent, then that raw material, there's one thing I cannot do without. I can get alternative materials. I can get alternative I cannot build homes without land. And that land must have planning permission unless I want to end up in jail. And so, it's fundamental to freeing up, but it drives productivity. And at the moment, I don't think that we're particularly efficient.
Fine. Thank you. Jackie, go on.
Well, we sure don't want to see you in jail, Jenny. I mean, just to say. But just before we leave planning, I think... Well, Peter and I have been working together for many years, as you know, and our struggle with it is that with the government, really. It seems to us that there's never any real push by government to ramp up supply, stuff that will stimulate supply, and that every time government's asked about housing, it points to the planning system and says, oh, what we're going to do is reform the planning system. And I'm sick to the back teeth of Treasury officials saying, it's all down to planning, because it isn't all down to planning. I mean, planning is a problem. We've got to sort the planning, but it isn't all down to planning. Would you agree with that? My thesis being with Treasury, physician, heal thyself. Go and sort out your Byzantine tax system and stop banging on about planning and let's get real about supply side initiatives that could really help the likes of Taylor Wimpey and others to build more homes.
I mean, I think that we have got ourselves to the point, Jackie, where there are so many problems that, it's almost can't see the wood for the trees. And I think the planning is a very substantial part of the issue. But I've just described too, then how it has ramifications on our ability to build skills, and the fundamental, sort of machinery then to increase build. I think the fact that land supply isn't coming through the land system or the planning system means that land prices are high, which means that we are all competing really quite, aggressively for land, which means that, there's not a great deal of elasticity in some of that competition. So, planning is definitely an issue, but there are other issues that we need to resolve. And I think the way that we as a country look at investment, innovation, driving productivity is something that needs to be reviewed as well.
Hi, Chloe here again. You're listening to Home Truths, a Building Talks podcast. We'll be back to Jackie and Peter in a moment, but first, a reminder. you can gain access to all the content on building.co.uk or housingtoday.co.uk by going to our websites and clicking subscribe. Now, back to Jackie and Peter.
So we rather reluctantly, because we thought it was the love that dare not speak its name, right? We eventually got to the point, Peter and I, of thinking, well, the only way we're going to crack the housing crisis, and you've already alluded to this or even said it just a few minutes ago, is by the re-emergence of council housing and local authorities bringing forward homes for land. Now, we've lost the borough engineer and the borough architect and the borough surveyor, haven't we? But you would welcome the re-emergence of council housing as part of a sectoral response to the housing crisis.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there are a lot of challenges, and it's not just about, you know, sort of provincial borrowing and, you know, sort of the finance end for councils. I mean, I have been around now for a very long time, but, you know, I remember the days when you would go to see the borough engineer or the borough chief planner or the borough treasurer, and they bring out their big linen terrier, you know, of where their land holdings were. I mean, local authorities are, you know, relatively land poor themselves. Now, there are very few that have vast amounts of land, but the public sector, whether it's MOD or NHS or others, you know, there's still public sector land available. I think I keep coming back to skills, and I think we do have to be really honest about the response to consistent constraint delivered, in my view, through planning and poor sort of land responsiveness means that skills are really, really tight. And so if councils are going to build housing, then we also need to invest in the skills to deliver that. There's not, you know, there's not a readily available, you know, sort of group of ex-CNT planners and engineers for them to utilise.
Yeah, I think Jackie and I have come to the conclusion that's a busted flush. Councils haven't got the ability to build state-subsidised houses anymore. You can just forget it. And that only leaves one group of people who can build houses: house builders.
And I think in the, you know,
so if would you get involved in the construction of state subsidised housing, I suppose, is the answer.
If you were to get to a point, you know, let's imagine, you know, sort of predictable, you know, certain planning environment that's delivering, you know, local plans, that's delivering land certainty, where it becomes, you know, I think of ourselves as house builders. We're a very customer-facing sort of organization. That's fundamentally important to the reputation and success of my business. But at the very front end, we are developers. There's a lot of speculation, you know, land, risk, and all of that requires reward through the process. The more readily available land is, the less the developer end of the risk, then the more and more you grow. And so if I can grow my business to meet demand, and there's an opportunity to add another value stream, which is doing then direct works for council or a housing association or other forms of partnership, then I'm going to embrace that.
Let's say you thought, well, blimey, yes, the Labour government is here now, and despite their lack of enthusiasm for what I'm about to say, they suddenly get the bright idea that they'd like to build some council houses, and they came to you and said, look, Jenny, we've got to get we've got to get more social rent houses, let's call them that, or what Jackie and I call public rental housing in our little paper we did for Localis a few months ago.
Because we were too scared to call it council housing.
So it's essentially an idea where the private sector takes the risk and the public sector puts in the land and maybe even the grants. Now, there is nobody to build these houses. If you got involved in that, would it become like, we'll just meld it into what we do and we'll build a few on the side of our existing sites? Or would it be, okay, Barking Council wants 1,000 council houses, we know how to build houses, we'll build them for you? In other words, there's a separate division of Taylor Wimpey.
I mean, look, that's something that could always be considered. And if you think back to, maybe your days in George Wimpey or, yeah. The other half of our business, which was Taylor Woodrow, they were contractors who became house builders.
Yes.
And so there's, what you're sort of describing is a house builder going back to contracting.
Yes.
And it's all about risk reward. But what you said that I'm interested in unpicking is the developer or the house builder takes the risk. But that's not an equal partnership. If the house builder's taking all the risk, then they're going to need to have a level of reward because by definition, some risk won't pay off. How's the balance going to be achieved?
I think you're in violent agreement on this, guys.
Yeah. What we suggested basically was instead of you getting 6% on the affordable, you got 20%, the same margin as you get on the private.
And that would be baked in?
And that has to be baked in. It's a site-by-site basis. It's based on the affordability of every of the sites that you do, and it's based upon whatever deal you do with the council.
Yeah.
You might say, well, we can afford only 5 council houses on that site, but we'll build them for you at 20% profit. That's the basis of this thing. It's not really aimed at huge builders like yourselves. It's aimed at small SME sites.
Yeah.
But that's the idea.
I think that risk-reward balance is there. And then we come back to skills. You've got to build this.
Yeah.
You've got to build the skills base up. We're only going to deliver more housing of any tenure if we get more people in to build. And it's one, if I can, it's one of the reasons why I get so frustrated with some of the negativity around house builders. Like, I'm big enough and ugly enough, I can take some of it. But I get really concerned about how that impacts mum and dad reading the broadsheets or reading the papers. And, son, daughter saying, actually, maybe that's an interesting career. Oh, actually, this sort of demonization of the sector. So I'm really, really keen that we tell some of the really good stories, the excellent delivery that we've had.
Well, the brickies always used to get paid a fortune in my day. still do they?
It's hard work. They still do. So we do need to drive up what we need to drive up. Is the skills base. And some of that is we've got to then have a more consistent supply of land, and other things have to be more predictable, because then we know that if we invest in building, factories for timber frame, which we're just, we've just commissioned our timber frame factory, or, when you look at some of the modular players and other things, actually, their problem isn't that they can't build the kit, it's that they can't get it onto the land to recover their investment. So land means freeing up the bottleneck, and that means investment in innovation, skills, increasing productivity and other things becomes really then a real opportunity. So timber frame, more traditional, I think open panel timber frame, where you can get the inspections clear, there's less risk, the fire risk issues, from decades ago, have been resolved through building regulations. But what's my aspiration? That 30% of my building output is in timber frame. I think that if I go well, if the adoption and adaption and of the business works well, then I might move to closed panel, and I could, extend the level of offsite. But I don't see it as replacing standard build in absolute terms.
Sounds like admirable caution. Thank you.
Well, there you go. I told you you'd be in violent agreement on that one. But can we go back to skills, Jenny? Mm-hmm. You alluded to, or tried to drag us to it several times before, and we sort of body swerved, which was a bit outrageous. But to be honest with you, it's a very knotty problem, isn't it? And I'm wondering what you would suggest to any incoming government about really upgrading how we deliver skills, ramp up the supply of training on construction skills. Have you got any ideas? I have to say, outing myself here, I've been in this game for something like 40 years, I haven't got a clue, really, about how you'd do it, other than go back to the old FE sector. But is that wrong? I don't know.
Yeah, I think, the FE sector still has, quite a number of schemes and courses that deliver, bricklaying and other things. But actually, some of the bricklayers that are coming out of FE colleges are still working to a 1970s, syllabus. They don't know how to do damproof courses and, real sort of basic. Yeah. Basic things. Look, I think when I talk about skills, I mean the whole gamut. So not just sort of the on-site build skills, but I mean, you know, getting into the supply chain, actually, yeah. You know, more planners in local authorities, more QSs, actually trying to get sort of the commercial teams now. You know, they're not seen as... You're not seen as the, you know, hip thing to do for...
It never was, Jenny.
But the very... I mean, I feel really passionate about it. And Jack, we've had conversations before.
We have.
Really rewarding career. And, you know, house building is quite the meritocracy. Start on site and you can build, you know, literally work your way up through the organization. It starts, I think, with education. At earlier though than FE colleges. You know, the idea that, you know, we're teaching and training our kids to think about IT and, you know, other roles. So we do, and a number of house builders do, you know, school engagement at primary school level, at secondary school level. We have apprentices that we recruit. We have apprentices that we sponsor into our supply chain. So brickies, carpenters, roofers. One of the important things for me and one of the actions that I need to, you know, take is if we're going into a process, you know, election and we come out with a new government, that we engage quickly to ensure that the best of what we've started to co-create is carried in, rather than, you know, that we start from, you know, the... sort of foundations, all over again.
There's still a levy. You're still paying these people.
We still pay the levy. It's a and it's a significant levy, and it can be very, very challenging to access. And we can see with the supply chain, you know, our subcontractors, you know, some of them are very small, as you know. We have a very, you know, large and quite fractured supply chain. So part of what we've also been doing is actually helping them signpost, you know, this is how you can access training, this is how you can access grant, and I'm working with them to help them navigate, because, you know, the health of my business is reliant upon the health of the supply chain. So we're doing quite a lot of work with supply chain to try and ensure that they're getting, as SMEs, what they're due out of CITB training as well.
Okay.
Well, there's no doubt at all it was a shed load of work to be done on all of this stuff. And I mean, you know, God knows. I mean, I'm assuming you would get your shoulder to the wheel with any incoming government to help on this stuff. You know, we've got to start to crack this problem. I remember you telling me, I don't know, something like 2014, 2015, that there was 1 million operatives in the construction industry were going to retire by 2020.
Yep.
I didn't sleep that night. I have to say, you know, it's a really intractable problem. And I'm thrilled to hear your kind of multifaceted approach to it, actually. And I didn't know you were in primary school, so that's bloody good news.
This is Home Truths, a Building Talks podcast.
I mean, I think we're coming to the if you had a magic wand point here, are we, Jackie?
Oh, no, this is something we ask all of our interviewees, Jenny. And, you know, God knows we wish we did have the magic wand. But just the one question, I suppose, is if you had a magic wand, what would be the one thing you would do?
Okay, so my wish would be that we have an intelligent, open conversation about housing in this country.
Okay.
Jenny, that's a brilliant response. And I want to thank you for your time today and your very, very thoughtful take on all of this. We greatly appreciate it. Thank you.
This is Home Truths, a Building Talks podcast.
Well, Peter, I don't know. I was very, very invigorated by that, really. I mean, it's no secret that, you know, she and I go back anyway. I mean, we're mates and, you know, I am a great admirer. We have had terrific differences in the past, but, you know, she does fight her corner. I am in total awe of her, really. And I think she really gave us a good... series of things to get our teeth into. She understands the problems. She's well connected into government. I just hope that the new government are going to listen to her.
Well, it would be nice to think they would. I think they probably are already talking with Labour, I imagine. It was nice to have explained by Jenny how house builders don't build for the good of government. They build for the good of their shareholders. And it was nice to have... not the admission, but just the plain truth is that 60 or 70% of Britain's housing output is controlled by the private market. It was nice to have it acknowledged that this isn't spoken about as much as it should be, when it comes to having housing targets. The fact that the number of homes built by the private sector go up and down with the economy is not well understood. And Jenny gave a really good explanation of how that is done, and why they build so many houses per week, and why they built 20% fewer last year, and why they might build 20% more next year. I do think that most house builders overplay the impact of planning, but she made some very fair points. I think that as a planner, she thinks problems need to be solved from the top down. I'm not sure that's the case. We've tried that before. But I think her views on the building of state subsidised houses, we call them, were very interesting.
Very interesting indeed. She didn't mention this, but her predecessor and mentor, Pete Redfern, who was chief executive of Taylor Wimpey before she became so, was very networked through the Labour Party and then through the coalition government. And they're very, very good at government affairs. So I do think that they will be trying to get their message in there. But it was very invigorating to hear her take on council housing in particular and her take on community tension that is caused by poor housing. I found that very illuminating.
I also grew up in Belfast as a youngster, and I remember there were areas you could live and there were areas you couldn't live. I always felt that the place was segregated by housing, and the housing was appalling, and it was tried to be fixed by, they had a Northern Ireland housing executive and so on to try and fix it. But I think she was right. At the bottom of the tensions in Northern Ireland was the houses that people lived in and where they were forced to live.
Well, as ever, Pete, it's been a blast.
Has, hasn't it, really? I quite enjoyed that one.
Thanks for listening to Home Truths, a Building Talks podcast. More from Jackie and Peter next Tuesday. And a final reminder that you can gain access to all of our content on building.co.uk or housingtoday.co.uk by going to the websites and clicking subscribe. Goodbye for now.